This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Aaron Copland composed some of the most popular works of American classical music ever written, like his ballets Rodeo, Billy the Kid, and Appalachian Spring, his Fanfare for the Common Man, and Quiet City. But one of his favorites of his own works was a piece that puzzled audiences at its first performances and was actually booed when it was revived 24 years later, his Symphonic Ode. He thought of it as the piece in which he announced that he had grown up, and many years after its composition, he tried to step back and paint a portrait of the work. "The ode resembles me at the time of my 30th birthday," he wrote, "full of ideas and ideals, introspective and serious, but still showing touches of youthful jazz days, reflections of a Jewish heritage, remnants of Paris, influences of Mahler and Stravinsky. It is not an ode to anything in particular, but rather a spirit that is to be found in the music itself." End quote. Copland was one of the first Americans to go to Paris for studies with Nadia Boulanger, one of the great composition teachers of the 20th century who also taught Philip Glass, Astor Piazzolla, and Quincy Jones, among others. She helped Copland develop the technique that freed him to be himself and helped him make some important connections as well. It was through her that he met Serge Koussevitzky, who became conductor of the Boston Symphony in 1924. Koussevitzky believed passionately in the cause of new music, and that it was his obligation as head of one of America's most important musical institutions to support American musicians. He presented Copland's Organ Symphony and went on to give the first performances of his Music for the Theater in 1925, Piano Concerto in 1927, and in 1932, the Symphonic Ode, which was commissioned for the Boston Symphony's 50th anniversary. But the orchestra couldn't handle the work's tricky time changes, and the premiere was postponed so Copland could simplify the notation. When Koussevitzky was finally able to introduce the work, it was generally well received in the press, but not by Boston's conservative concertgoers. In the words of American composer John Adams, the young Copland was, in the minds of the polite audiences of the BSO, a hooligan. Another performance in 1932 in Mexico City under Carlos Chavez went well, but that was the last time anyone would play the ode until a concert at the Juilliard School in 1946. As the Boston Symphony's 75th anniversary rolled around, Copland revised the score, but this time reviews were thoroughly negative, and Copland found the conducting of Charles Munch stiff and unconvincing. "I sure do wish I could hear it conducted by an American," he said. The Symphonic Ode occupies an almost unique place in Copland's catalog. It is clearly not one of his more populist works, like the ballets. In some ways, it's one of his least characteristic works, and one of his most deliberately in-your-face compositions. But it's not nearly as craggy and dissonant as other modernist works, like the Orchestral Variations. Copland himself described it as having the beginnings of a purer, non-programmatic style, an attempt toward an economy of material and transparency of texture that would be taken much further in the next few years. "I was attempting to write a piece of music with an unbroken logic, so thoroughly unified that the very last note bears a relation to the first. I used a two-measure blues motif from my Nocturne for Violin and Piano of 1926 as the musical basis of all five sections." End quote. The ode begins in what composer Philip Ramey has called Copland's laying down the law mood, with trumpets and trombones, filling the hall with proclamations. They're soon joined by the horns and answered by high winds and strings. Eventually, the whole orchestra joins the conversation. The lines are jagged, leading to some very dissonant combinations, but also to some forcefully pronounced major triads. The conversation softens and becomes more lyrical, led by a single muted trumpet. The strings enter, with interweaving lines forming a counterpoint. The speed increases, and eventually becomes a real allegro. This is probably the point where Koussevitzky and that 1930 Boston Symphony broke down. It's a scherzo with constant shifts in meter. The music is exuberant, humorous, very physical and athletic. But suddenly, the slow music from the beginning returns. In a series of wind solos, starting with the flute. There is an extended solo for oboe. Joined by the bassoon and clarinet, and filled out by the strings. Until it reaches a grand climax. Soon, instruments begin to vanish around the edges, leaving only a few winds. Then the scherzo reappears. But quietly, and punctuated by brush strokes on a cymbal. This time it leads to what Copeland might have called a hoochie-coochie dance. It's begun by the timpani and piano, with violists pretending they're percussionists too. The tempo slows majestically, close to what it was in the beginning. Melodies and harmonies begin to pile up, there's the Mahler influence. Copland brings his symphonic ode to its grand finale with a triumphant major chord. The poor reception that the symphonic ode received caused Copland to rethink his approach to music. He started to wonder whether composing for a small group of modernist connoisseurs was the best way to serve his art or his bank account in the midst of the Depression. His focus began to shift to a more accessible, populist style. The symphonic ode gave way to rodeo, and Copland the Hooligan eventually became Copland, the Dean of American Music. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.